people and tell them where I was. Dude, I'm at the White House. No, literally, I'm standing 50 yards from the West Wing on the lawn. I would go on about how close I was to the president and his family. I'd make jokes about snipers and national security. I didn't realize that we were being listened to outside on the lawn until a producer told me. I could not have been the only dumb young guy saying stupid shit on the White House grounds, but I sure felt like the loudest one in that moment. A lot of it was cool, but also something was pretty clear to me. I didn't want to do this job for the rest of my life. I love crime stories. I love reading about them. I love watching the shows about them. But I didn't love meeting the victims. It was all too much. I can still see that girl in Costa Rica. Even with all the jokes that I make about crimes and chaos on my podcast, they can't cover how soft I am. They can't mask that I'll break down crying if the person in front of me shares a tragic story about their life. I've made jokes about murder and plotting to kidnap someone. I've gone into detail about how to evade capture and what to consider when planning a homicide. But it's not something I want to do. It's a fantasy world. That's the one thing that I feel like so many comedy fans get wrong. There's this widespread belief that any joke a comedian makes is rooted in truth. That if a comedian says anything on a deeper level, the comic must feel that way. This could not be more inaccurate. What is true is that a comedian will say anything if they think it's funny, and sometimes, there's truth in the joke. A lot of times, there isn't. I remember early on inviting a girl to see me do stand-up. While on stage, I had a joke about peeing on someone. I don't remember exactly what I said or how I got there, but I do remember saying, "And then I peed on him." It was a joke. Not a brilliant joke, but nevertheless, a joke. It was absurd to say in the context of what I was describing. Also, it was completely made up. I didn't actually pee on anyone. It was also an effective statement to say on stage. I know this because everybody laughed and I kept it in my act during that time. See, that's the thing we care about most. Did people laugh? If they did, then I'll keep saying that. After the show, the girl and I hung out and she could not stop saying, "Now I know you like to pee on people. That's your thing, huh? Oh my God, I figured you out. I know you want to pee on everybody." At first, I laughed, but then it became apparent that she really believed it, and she couldn't stop referencing it with a knowing look in her eye, like she'd cracked the case of the piss stalker. I broke it down that it wasn't true, and then she thought I was ashamed, like I was now denying my deep, dark secret that was masked in jokes. She wanted me to know that it was okay and that she was okay with my kink. She kept telling me it was okay that I was into pee. I kept saying that I wasn't, but it didn't matter. She was convinced that she had uncovered this secret through her elite psychological instincts, something I've encountered countless times during conversations with casual stand-up fans. I was so annoyed with this chick that I'm embarrassed to say that I did something I'd never done before. I peed on her. I pissed all over her face and her mouth and her hair. And much to my surprise, I really did enjoy it. If we ever meet and you want to give me a treat, don't offer to buy me a drink. Let me pee on you. Serena Williams.
American 1422, PBI to LAX, 10:18 a.m.
I was trying to stuff my bag in the overhead compartment. They design those things to minimize the amount of stuff you can bring on board with you. Why? They want you to check that bag, because if you check that bag, you pay and they win. I ain't having that shit. I stuff that bag every time. Just as I was getting the bag with all my shit into the compartment that didn't want it, I heard, "Excuse me," very politely said. I turned, saw the woman standing outside the row I was in, and I immediately said, "You're the greatest." I said that because I was looking at Serena Williams, aka the greatest. I don't think I'd ever been as starstruck. As we took off, I couldn't help myself. I made small talk. I can't believe I'm sitting next to you. Well, you are. She was fun and clearly not taking herself too seriously. I asked if she lived in LA, and she told me that she was only visiting because Florida was her primary home. Once we were at cruising altitude, she opened her laptop and began taking notes. Lots of notes in a pad. After a while, I asked what she was doing.
School.
School? You're in school? Yeah, I'm taking classes. It never occurred to me that a superstar athlete might want to further their education. But at that moment, I thought, oh yeah, you can keep learning even when you're successful. Cool. We ended up talking a good while before she asked what I did. This is, of course, the norm on flights. People always ask what you do. And it doesn't take long for comedians to realize that it's not a good idea to tell strangers you're a comedian. If you don't know why, imagine how you would react if the person sitting next to you said that they were a comedian. You're probably not done asking questions, right? When you're first starting out, it's kind of cool to tell people. I mean, you're new to it too. It's affirmation that you're actually doing it for real. It doesn't take long for you to put together that if you tell people you work in comedy, they're going to talk to you for the rest of the flight. And they're going to have a lot to say. I've heard every type of question and comment from all types.
Comedy? I love comedy.
You know, people say I'm pretty funny.
What kind of comedy do you do?
Can you tell me a joke?
Do you curse?
Are you on Saturday Night Live?
I love SNL.
Kristen Wiig was my favorite.
Do you watch
Who are your favorite comics?
What's your style like?
Have you seen this thing in the news with Syria? How would you joke about that?
Oops!
I spilled on my... I guess that's going in your act, huh? Yeah, I can't wait to get on stage tonight and tell them how you spilled coffee on your pants, fuckface. Most working comedians develop a reflex for dismissing any notion they're a comedian on flights. I either say I work in production and like creating schedules, or I say I work as a consultant in construction. Most people don't have a lot of follow-ups on that. One time, I thought I was clever and said I worked with pens, as in the manufacturing of pens. And the guy had so many goddamn questions about pens, so I dropped that one. But when Serena Williams asks what you do, you tell her the truth. Not just because it's the right thing to do, but in this case, her asking me questions was welcomed. I was cool, but not too cool with it. I'm a comedian. Her reply? Anywhere I can watch you? I mean, that is the perfect response. And I had the perfect reply. It was about a year after my first one-hour special had come out. I have a special on Netflix called Completely Normal. She smiled, and get this, she wrote it down on her notepad. Then I spelled my name out and watched her write that down too. It was actually a very cool moment. When we landed, I asked her for a pic, which she was very sweet about. I mean, I don't have makeup on, we just flew, but okay. I was extremely pleased with myself as I walked through the airport toward ground transportation. I imagined Serena Williams would be watching my special Completely Normal that night. Fuck! At that moment, it hit me. In that special, I actually talk about Serena Williams. And what I say is exactly this. Oh my God, I do think about death. I just want it to be justified, you know? Like if I die violently, maybe I have Serena Williams sitting on my face and I don't know, Venus is polishing me off and they're trying to fit a racket in my ass or something like that. And then my wife comes in and boom, I'm fucking done. Keep in mind, I wasn't saying this in an interview. It was during a stand-up performance. During stand-up, we exaggerate, often in extreme ways, which is why a lot of people laugh. It's not what you ever say in regular conversation. That's the magic of a stand-up performance. In the act, I was talking about only wanting to die if it were justified, worth it. Still, I was appalled, not that I'd said it, but that it could be interpreted by her as a not-so-hidden message from me. Hey, watch my special. I think you'll like it. Wink, wink. It was absolutely not my intention to do that. I think both of the Williams sisters are lovely, inspiring, super talented athletes, and what I say on stage is not meant to translate into the real world. I really had forgotten about that bit, and now I had to process that I'd suggested to this woman I admire that she watch me talk about a threesome with her and her sister and an enormous apparatus shoved up my ass right before I die. At that moment, I wanted to die. Of course, I never heard from Serena, but earlier this year, I did run into her. I realized how casual I made that sound. I ran into Serena at the store. Nice gal. Pretty cool chick. Not what I mean. I cannot believe that I ran into her after a show. She and her husband, who I'm sure didn't tell her he wanted to die the same way I did, were a few feet ahead of me at a party. I was drunk and high when I spotted them. The perfect combination when you want to relive an embarrassing story with someone. I approached the two of them 15 feet from the bar and held them captive as I retold the entire story you just heard. My intention was to make them laugh. And it worked with Alexis, her husband, who was ear to ear smiling. Serena was politely listening, not as entertained as I'd hoped. Was it because she did watch and was remembering the bit? I felt a sweat start to build. It's one that I've felt before. Am I bombing? At one point, I could feel the shame working its way from my face down my body, and I said to them in a not-so-quiet voice, I think I'm humiliating myself right now. I've been drinking. To which Serena replied, we're trying to get on your level. Where can we get a drink? And I pointed to the bar. I am making you a promise. If I ever run into Serena Williams again, I am not bringing any of this up. Road Dog. There's no business like show business. And if show business doesn't want you, there's always comedy. Nothing can truly prepare you for life as a road comic. People see successful comics and naturally assume that it's awesome. It is. It's great to have people want to come out to see you do what you chose to do in life. It's great to get paid well and fly comfortably and stay in nice hotels, but it takes most of us who do this a long, long time to get there. Hundreds and thousands of shows. I mean it. So many countless awful hours doing so many awful shows. On the way up, you suffer in more ways than one, and I wouldn't change anything about my experience. Here, I present to you my top five list of the most glamorous things about being a stand-up comedian. Number five, you'll share a shitty condo with someone you don't know, and they might not be the best roommate. Comedy clubs are famously cheap. They sling wings and beers, and they're not known for paying well. Before you get to the level where you stay in hotels, you stay in what is known as a comedy condo. It's essentially an apartment or condo that the club has purchased. They normally are quite negligent of the property. They don't really clean it well or maintain it in a way that would make you want to reside there. It is, however, a tax write-off for the scumbag owner of the club who also happens to own that condo. By making the comedian stay there, he is writing off the cost of the property as a business expense. These places are usually impressively shitty. They are dated with furniture that was clearly bought whenever the property was purchased 10, 15, 20 years before. Carpets with cigarette burns, televisions with no remote, and the worst of all, bedroom windows with no curtains or blinds. This is a particularly egregious crime as most comedians don't go to bed until well after midnight when working a club. And without curtains, well, you can imagine. No one wants a well-lit bedroom when they're trying to sleep the morning away. All the condos I stayed at were garbage, with the exception of Wendy Curtis's condo in downtown Denver. She owns the Comedy Works clubs and a host of other businesses, and since she actually values the comedians she puts on her stages, she spent over $1 million purchasing and renovating a condo for the performers to stay in. Again, she is the rare exception. I once shared a condo with a 600-pound man. That is not an exaggeration. It was an astonishing experience to be that close to someone in that body. Normally, you only see it when the good people at the TLC network launch a new show, 1,000-Pound Sisters, My 600-Pound Life, or my favorite of theirs, Fat Black Midgets. This guy was a very troubled but extremely funny comic. He was a single dad working the road like the rest of us. I shared the condo with him that weekend, and I'll never forget it. He was absolutely enormous. The craziest part, the condo had one bathroom. We both bathed and relieved ourselves in the same space. When he shit, the smell would penetrate the walls. If you think I'm suggesting that a super obese person's bowels smell worse than the average person's, you are correct. I've never been around anything like it. In the mornings, when I wanted to go out for breakfast, I would knock on his door and ask if he wanted to come with me. He said he did and that he just needed a minute. It would take him 45 minutes just to get out of the room. It was sad, of course. We walked into a restaurant, and before I sat down, I turned and noticed he was gone. I went outside, and he was already getting into the car. "What are you doing?" "They only have booths in there. Can't fit." And we'd be off to look for another restaurant with tables and chairs. Damn. I'd never thought of that. I thought of myself as fat, but I never had to leave a place because I couldn't fit. He was clearly used to it, but I was taken aback. As eye-opening as that weekend was, the one that left me a little terrified was when I was paired up with an older opening act. He was resentful that I was headlining, as that had been his job a few years back. It's something that happens in the world of comedy and entertainment. You rise, plateau, and then decline. I'm hyper aware that it can happen to me, and I'm always extremely polite to upperclassmen in my field. With this guy, it became obvious almost immediately that he was a big-time drinker. Some comics have a drink before going on stage, and a whole lot like to drink after the show, but this was different. This guy started at noon, and he only drank whiskey. We went to have lunch, as is typical for comics working a weekend together, and he abruptly shifted the conversation from comedy to whether or not I liked my wife. "I do." "Is she smart?" "She is." "Well, mine's about as dumb as they make them." I laughed it off as an older guy venting about his longtime marriage. Then, that Saturday after the late show, we went back to the condo. He was 15 drinks deep. We were watching Cops, and it must have been at least 2 a.m. "You ever see the Paris Hilton sex tape?" Seemed like an odd segue, but I had no reason to lie to him. Yeah, I think we all did. "That guy's got a nice cock on him, huh?" I never really thought about it. I mean, I'm sure he didn't mind that getting out there. Right. I mean, there's a lot of chicks to bang out there, but there's a lot of guys, too. What the fuck? I froze as my new reality hit me. This guy wants to fuck me, and he's hammered. I felt like reacting would be a bad move. So I sat still and just stared at the TV. I told myself any sudden movement would escalate the situation. So I decided at the commercial break, I would go to my room. A few minutes passed, and thankfully, a commercial came on, and I did just that. Nothing was said. Once I was inside the room, my fear kicked in again. This guy weighed 100 pounds less than me, but I was still in a state of panic. I pushed the dresser in front of my bedroom door, then the nightstand, then a chair. I needed fair warning if this maniac tried to come in. Was this drunk creeper going to try something? Not a chance I'd be falling asleep anytime soon. I lay in bed wide-eyed. Hours later, I passed out. The next morning, I got up, and he was gone. Number 4, you might not get paid. This might shock you when you read the Forbes list of the top earning comics in the world, but if that list went on, it would show a severe drop. Most comedians barely make a living. Barely. A large number of them have part-time jobs while they try to make it as a comic. I was one of those guys for a while. I worked in restaurants, on set for TV, film productions, doing various menial jobs, and of course, a spa. If you're not clear why a working comedian who just performed in front of a packed house needs another job, let me break it down for you. Most comedy clubs across the United States operate the same way. There's an MC who opens the show, greets the audience, and returns to the stage to introduce each comic and make club announcements. This comedian is usually paid $50 per show. That's the same rate they were paid in 1990. The feature or middle act usually does 20 minutes of stand-up. This comedian is usually paid $100 per show. And then the headliner, the person whose name is on the marquee and presumably who all the people are there to see, well, that has a sliding scale. On the low end, it might be $1,000 for 6 shows. Keep in mind, you don't work every weekend. So if you headline 2 weekends, at that rate, you're essentially making $500 a week, and you need another job. One comedy club manager gave me shit for not going long enough in the middle spot. I did 22 minutes instead of 25 minutes. She insulted me all weekend long. I thought you were supposed to be funny. And after all her bullshit, I get back to LA, and the check bounces. Nothing makes you feel quite as empty as not getting paid after a bad week. I worked at a pizza place in the San Fernando Valley to make ends meet. I dug a ditch once. I'm not saying I was a ditch digger, but I did dig the one. It was for a super rich guy in Bel Air. A friend had referred me over for some construction work since I had done some one summer during college. When I got to this massive house, I thought I'd be laying tile or passing cinder blocks up a line. Nope. Dig a ditch there. Where? Right there. I looked up and saw the order wasn't coming from a contractor. This was the owner. Had to be. He was wearing slacks, a button-down shirt with the 2 top buttons open, and he was holding a little white Maltese. We had one when I was a kid. I complimented his dog and then asked for some clarity. Sir, you want a ditch right here next to the house? I've got some big plans for it. For the ditch? Okay. He left, and the contractor showed up about 15 minutes later. All the other guys were doing labor in the house, but I had a shovel and was doing what I was told. The fuck are you doing? Digging a ditch. Mind telling me why? The owner told me he wanted it here, so I just started digging. He, yep, came right up to me with his dog and said to dig right here. The owner of this house is a woman. Fill that fucking hole up. Okay. Number 3. Oh, the places you'll go. I've had countless conversations with strangers about the fact that I'm a stand-up comic. Almost every one of those conversations leads to the stranger saying something to the effect of, "It must be so great to travel and see the world." I can tell their own fantasies of globetrotting are playing in their heads, not realizing that we are business travelers, going anywhere and everywhere. Winnipeg in the winter, Phoenix in the summer. I've performed at music festivals, dive bars, parking lots, and minor league baseball games. I've done long weekends in some real shitholes, and I've even gone as far as doing stand-up comedy in Guantanamo Bay. Yep, Gitmo. You probably heard about it on the news. After 9/11, the United States began scooping up and shipping out a lot of bad guys, and some guys they weren't so sure about, to this naval base in Cuba. Within the base, there's a prison. That's all I knew about it, that terrorists like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed were there, and that it has to be awful. So when I got the call saying, "Do you want to do some shows in Guantanamo?" I thought, are they really trying to entertain a prison camp? Then they told me something that for some reason I couldn't picture. Gitmo is a base, and the prison is a very small part of it. So we're not entertaining the prisoners? No. I flew to Fort Lauderdale and then jumped on a U.S. Navy plane with a few other comics, and we landed at the base with some serious anxiety. What the hell did we just agree to do? We were greeted by uniformed personnel and told that our group would have to split up. Two of us would go to the regular housing, and two of us would have to go elsewhere. I was put in the elsewhere group, which turned out to be housing for naval officers, CIA, and other U.S. intelligence officers who were temporarily on site. It was, as I later found out, much more desirable housing. It had Wi-Fi and decent bedding and CIA officers. I felt like I was on an official top-secret mission. After a short period of settling in, I was told to meet a guide in the lobby of the building. I took the elevator and shared it with a man about 20 years older than me. He had a slight build, a serious look on his face, and a mustache. He was wearing shorts, a t-shirt, and sneakers, and was clearly going out for exercise. I tried to talk him up. "How's it going?" His eyes barely looked at me. "I'm here doing shows." The elevator hit the lobby and he exited. I can't ever remember being dissed so quietly and efficiently in my life. And I wasn't the least bit insulted. I thought, that's how CIA guys must be? Awesome. Once in the van with our guide, we were given a tour of the base. We had all braced ourselves for some seriously depressing, "you ain't in Kansas anymore" shit. But what we discovered was KFC. It had the Colonel's Chicken, Subway, post office, parks, a high school, and oh yeah, kids, a bunch of kids whose parents live and work on base. The shows ended up being incredible. Everyone was so appreciative and enthusiastic. It really made me feel like we were doing something of substance just by going there and entertaining these dedicated sailors, soldiers, and Marines. A few days later, we flew out and went back to our homes. A month later, I was in Atlanta playing a club, and in the lobby of my hotel, I saw a face that I recognized. Now, I travel a lot, so I do see and meet a ton of people, but this face was bugging me. It was like I was certain I had seen this man, but I couldn't quite place where I knew him from. I was staring, wondering, and then it hit me. Gitmo. This was the guy who I rode the elevator with. The one who didn't even acknowledge me when I tried speaking to him. So what did I do? I walked over to him. "Hey, I recognize you." He just stared at me, stone-faced. "I was at Gitmo last month in the officer's building. We rode the elevator together." Before I had finished my sentence, he had turned his back to me and walked away. Now I really felt fear for the first time. What the fuck is wrong with me? Of all the people I could tap on the shoulder and say hey to, I pick a guy who maybe sets up black op sites and possibly teaches people how to waterboard. That was my last trip to Gitmo and the last time I ever acknowledged a stranger. Number two, some people will hate you, and that's a good thing. When you start doing stand-up, the only feedback you get is usually positive. I mean, you're terrible, but people can tell you're not experienced, so they take it easy on you. It's friends and supportive types that go to these bringer shows, shows where you, the performer, are supposed to literally bring people to watch it. They tend to be like parents at a kindergarten talent show. "Hey, way to go! I can't believe you even have the balls to get up there. Yay, you!" As you progress into more professional shows with real audiences, you certainly have a sense about when you did well and when you didn't. Some comics remain delusional, but even they know the truth. No matter what happens at live shows, nothing can quite prepare you for what the digital age has brought into our everyday life: the comments. When your comedy is posted online, you want everyone to see it. When people start seeing it, they start leaving comments, and oh boy, you are not ready. "You suck! Don't quit your day job! I've been to funerals that were funnier." Your heart drops. You sink. Why are people being so mean to me? By now, you know that the internet is a vast wasteland. And if you're looking for care and comfort, you might want to reconsider looking for it online. As your profile grows as a comedian, you will gain more fans and people that aren't into you. And some of those people feel the need to tell you. Posting a video on YouTube is one thing. But having a worldwide release on Netflix is another. You are literally at 140 million subscribers' mercy. And when you lean aggressively into a joke or just joke about something, anything that someone takes personally, you will be hearing from some of them. Seems easy to say, well, just ignore them. It's true, and it's good advice, but it's much easier said than done. Comedians are comedians for a reason. We didn't get the approval we were seeking as children. We want validation every day. Every show is not just a show and a place for us to try jokes. It's a place to get the affirmation we're on an endless journey to obtain. When you first read the hate, don't let anyone fool you. It sucks and it hurts. You eventually get used to it. One of my friends likes to say it's snake venom. You take a little bit and build up a tolerance to it, and then one day it doesn't affect you. It took me years and years to get there, and now I can say with full confidence that I accept it as part of the job. You're never going to win everyone over. Not everyone is going to think you're funny or like you. And just like not every movie is for everyone, neither is every comic. I do think it makes sense for people not to agree on who is funny or what is funny. It's completely subjective, and we all have different experiences to inform our opinions. Hate mail also means that more people are learning who you are. You're becoming more famous. Really famous people get tons of hate thrown their way. Think about it. Taylor Swift, Brad Pitt, and Scarlett Johansson are wildly famous and without question receive tons of adulation and also more hate mail than you or I. That being said, you're still a complete asshole and total psycho if you go to any artist's social media or website and send them messages about how you don't like their song or movie or joke. I'm trying to imagine doing that. I can't even imagine being friends with someone who would openly admit that they do that. After years and years of growing accustomed to it, I learned to at least have a little fun with it. When my Netflix special, Disgraceful, debuted, I was bombarded with hate mail on every platform, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and my website. Every hour I could go to any of those, and there would be 100 new messages in each, thousands per day. Day after day, the number was growing. A huge portion of them were coming from Louisiana. I had joked in the special that I had met a man from Lafayette, which I did. We had a difficult-to-understand conversation because his accent was ridiculous. The bit then shifts to me railing against Cajun people and stating that I don't understand why they have rights. Then I state that we should build a wall in this country, but we should build it around their state. You get it. It was harsh, but you know, comedy. So many people were enraged and contacting me about my Louisiana jokes that I decided the best thing to do was keep them writing. So I pretended to be Blake, Tom Segura's assistant, in charge of running his social media. I mean, my social media. The following is a real exchange via the Messenger app on Facebook. A lady messaged me. Just had to let you know that not everyone from Louisiana is moronic. We do not all speak as though we are holding marbles in our mouths. You are a douchebag for that joke. People in Louisiana liked you. Fuck you, sir. Go chew an aspirin. And Blake replied, Heather, my goodness, I'm Blake. I work for Tom and monitor his social media. What's this aspirin thing about? She replied, aspirin tastes bad, like Tom's dumb jokes. Let him read the message. Hell, read it to his ancient ass. Sorry to hear you have to monitor his social media. I work for an asshole too. Blake, you have no idea. Tom is the worst. One time I brought him an iced coffee with too little ice. Turns out he likes extra ice. You know what he did? He made me stay awake for 3 days. Oh, I was so angry. It made me sick. I had to see a psychiatrist. He said it was punishment for bringing the wrong kind of caffeine, and since I wasn't helping him stay awake, he was going to force me to stay awake. He made me stay at his house, and he'd play loud music and turn all the lights on, and then he had his friend Capital J basically torture me. He's such a jerk. The lady, OMG. I'm so sorry. You seem cool, and I love your name. Blake. Thanks! I like your name too. I want to quit this job, but it's hard with the bills and all.
I just have to read all this stuff and reply and only pass on certain ones to him. Sometimes if I pass on the wrong message, I get punished for that too. One time he poured hot wax from a candle in my ears. He thought, earwax, candle wax, what's the difference? But the candle wax was so hot it damaged my ear canal and eardrum. At least he bought me some nice hearing aids, though. But I have permanent hearing loss thanks to him.
The lady.
Man, he's more of an asshole than I thought. So sorry. You should send me a friend request. Maybe we can be friends if you like.
Blake.
Oh yeah, he's a much bigger asshole offstage. Thanks for letting me vent. I'll never forgive him for what he did to my brother. He promised to make him some s'mores on Halloween, and my brother, who is 7, was so excited. But Tom thought it'd be hilarious to make them with hallucinogens. And now my brother only speaks using numbers. It's out of this world. Instead of saying I'm hungry, he'll say 268, 493, 1171. It took us forever to understand what the hell it means. He goes to a therapist 5 days a week to learn words again. Tom pays for it, but still, my parents are so upset.
The lady. That's evil. Wow.
I'm so sorry. Your poor baby bro. That's heartbreaking. Well, I have no problem at all with you venting. I vented to you, didn't I? How old are you?
Blake.
I'm 27. He's terrifying. Thanks for listening.
Lady.
Okay, don't let him walk all over you.
Blake.
Yeah, I'll try. I mean, he made me wear this protective suit so he could try out some martial arts stuff he's learning, but I'm so much smaller than him. He separated my right shoulder. Since I had to wear a sling, he told me to pretend to be a 3-legged dog. I had to eat out of a bowl and sit in a cage like a dog. He is nuts, but he pays well. Oh, the lady. Oh, my God. Wow, Blake. You're a stronger person than me. I thought my boss was an asshole. Now I feel blessed. Look, if you ever want to talk to someone, I'm here. You seem like a cool person. You don't deserve that crap.
Blake.
Thanks. He keeps stockpiling guns and playing with bullets in front of the staff here. Makes me anxious. He shot at a FedEx guy and somehow got out of it. Pretty crazy. And the cops love him. They let him put police lights and a siren on his car because he donated so much.
The lady.
What a shithead. That's not cool. I'm kind of glad his joke pissed me off now. He's so uncool anyway. You seem to be, though. I wonder how you put up with it.
Blake.
I just need the job. It's a job, and sometimes he can be cool. Pays for dinner and stuff, but then he'll make me give him pedicures, and I have to wash his underwear by hand. One time he locked me in an outhouse at his uncle's place in Idaho. The smell was unbearable. Plus, I'm diabetic, so I had some real trouble stabilizing without food for so long. That was another hospital stay because of him. But he got me this cool Harry Potter collection, which I love, so I forgave him.
End of convo. Number 1. You might die. The road can kill you. You're not in your home city and you have everything at your disposal. Food, booze, drugs, sex, and crowds that want to give you all those things. You can go down a dark path if you choose to. It sounds dramatic, but it's true. I know people who have eaten, drank, and drugged themselves to death. While a lot of people see doing comedy as fun, the road can be a very lonely place. You need to work at not falling apart. And the older you get, the harder you have to work at it. In 2006, I quit my last full-time job working as a post-production coordinator on reality TV shows. That job entails a lot of organizing and scheduling the post needs for the shows. I quit the day I signed with my manager. I shouldn't have quit so abruptly, but I was excited and told myself that I was now doing this for real. I would now be full-time as a comedian. No longer would this be something I dabbled in at night or on the weekends with the security of a real full-time job to back me up. I went on the road almost every week. I took everything that was offered to me, most of it feature work, $100 a show, still the same rate today, usually 6 shows a week with no airfare included. That means a lot of times I was netting maybe $200 a week, maybe less. I had to accrue debt. As the year went on, I told myself that there was no turning back. I would not stop trying to make it as a comic now, but the reality of my situation was stressful. You can't force more work or a raise at this point in your career. You just have to go along with it and build your proficiency as it comes. It's probably the hardest part of the whole journey, accepting that you're doing all you can and that it's barely enough. By the end of 2006, I had gained 30 pounds. The next year, I put on 20 more. The weight maintenance battle is one that I have always fought, and I was losing it badly. I was eating like shit, going to bed at 3 a.m., getting up at noon, and never, ever exercising. In 2009, I played a pickup game of basketball. I used to play pickup games at the Y in Hollywood all the time when I first arrived. Some ballers and really scrappy dudes would play. We would play for hours. This 2009 game was 7 years later. It was unexpected and a real wake-up call. If you know me, you're probably thinking of another basketball event and wondering if this encounter tops that one. No, we will get to that special one later. In 2009, I was hanging out with comics on the road, and there happened to be a court next to our hotel. I had really devolved into a slow, fat, sloppy bag of dog shit. That 2009 game started as a shoot-around. Everyone was just loosely having fun, but the familiar feeling of playing ball woke up the athletic dude buried deep beneath my many layers of fat. Instead of playing horse, I insisted that we play 21. 3 of us would battle for every shot, every point. There was the typical running, jumping, pivoting, and shoving that goes on in any basketball game, but it was all happening to a body that hadn't moved in half a decade. A body that was decidedly slower, weaker, and totally unprepared to take on this task. I played terribly that day. I was glad we did it because it felt good to sweat, play a game, and just compete. What I was not prepared for was what my body would do in response. The next morning, I woke up in pain. Real pain. I banged my knee on the cabinet, and then there's something is wrong. I can't move pain. This was the latter. The pain in my back was so severe that I had tears in my eyes. I couldn't sit up. I couldn't walk, sit, or stand. It was all encompassing. I held onto the wall, telling the other guys that I didn't think I could perform that night. They asked if I wanted to go to the hospital. I considered it, but decided that I needed to rest. One of the guys tried to crack my back. It didn't help. They kept trying to figure out what exactly was hurt. Was it nerve damage? Skeletal? I had gotten so out of shape that merely playing a casual game of basketball made my back hurt like I had fought someone in the ring. It took me days to get back to normal, and I knew that I had let myself go. It woke me up to get back to working out and eating better. And 2010 was somewhat of a turnaround for me. I lost some weight and then shot my Comedy Central half-hour special. It wouldn't be the end of reminding myself to stay healthy, though. That's a constant. It took the birth of my first son to remind me, don't get reckless and die. This time I lost 50 pounds and have kept most of it off. I have 2 kids now, and so the reminder is daily. That and the comics who are no longer with us. Greg Giraldo, Ralphie May, Mitch Hedberg, Chris Farley, Patrice O'Neill, Brody Stevens, and so many more. I hear a voice sometimes telling me, take care of yourself. Don't be reckless and die. Bank shot. I moved to Los Angeles when I was 22 years old. I just wanted to perform comedy in some way. I thought acting was the natural path for me. I'd done improv and sketch when I was in high school, though only for one summer. I had a small part in a community play, also during my high school years, and I'd shot countless comedy videos with my friends. I knew I could do it. I was funny. I could access emotions, And I was also really good at memorizing. So here was my plan. I'd read that a number of Saturday Night Live stars had been trained at the Groundlings, an improv school in Los Angeles. In my mind, all I needed to do was train there, get on SNL, and then after a few seasons, I'd do movies. Solid plan, Tom. LA is a huge city full of people looking to find their way among the millions of others who seem to know what they're doing. There, I felt like I had no one, because I didn't. I needed a friend. At the Groundling School, I became friendly with some of the other students. Still, I wouldn't become close with any of them. They already had their own crew. I wasn't a friendless loser forever, though. The Groundlings led me to stand-up. And it was stand-up that would lead me to some of the closest relationships I've ever had. The first great friend I made in Los Angeles was Ryan Sickler. Ryan hails from Baltimore, one of the country's toughest cities, and he has that city in his DNA. He'll talk shit as hard as anyone I've ever met, but at his core, he is a sweet, caring guy. Ryan is a few years older than me, and believe me, you can tell when you look at him, and he already had his bearings in LA when we met. He introduced me to comedy show bookers, took me to all his favorite food spots, and invited me to hang out at his place. I more than accepted the welcome. I practically moved in. I don't think he was anticipating having me there at his place every day, but that's just the kind of guy I am. If I like you, I will come around. Ryan had a great setup, a nice apartment, but more importantly, he always had the latest PlayStation, and we would sometimes play until sunrise. We played like Sony was paying us to test their games. God, I miss having no responsibilities so much, dude. Madden, Halo, Splinter Cell were all on regular rotation. I started dating my wife, Christina, in 2005, but Ryan has had a series of girlfriends, some for one night, others for a few years. Whenever he was single, I'd keep my eyes open for him. Over time, I learned his type: pretty, curvy, funny, with a preference for Latinas and Black women. So it came as no surprise when, a few years ago, I was standing in line at a Wells Fargo branch and thought of Ryan immediately when I saw that the woman behind the counter was a beautiful, olive-skinned woman. Damn, Ryan would dig her. When I approached the counter, I became even more convinced. She had a big, beautiful smile, and best of all, she was fun. Just making a deposit. You leaving any for me? You know, if I had more, I would. When I left, I called him right away. Hey, man, I think I found your next girlfriend.
Who?
She's a teller at Wells Fargo. Absolutely gorgeous. Olive-skinned, curvy, and a great attitude.
Shit, I like that.
Want me to try to set it up?
You got a picture?
Of the bank teller? Yeah, right next to the pictures of my butcher and the mailman. No, but she's smoking hot. Trust me.
Kind of need to see her first.
Seriously? You don't trust me?
I don't do blind dates.
Can you believe this shit? Here I am, thinking of my single friend, knowing that I'm looking at a woman he'd like, and he hits me with, I need to see a picture first. Fine. I let it go. A few weeks later, I was back at the same branch, in the same line, looking at tweets on my phone, when I saw her again. She looked even better. Without thinking, I hit the camera app, raised my phone, and snapped a few pictures of her. Now he'll see. Once again, I was impressed with her conversational skills. I mean, she noticed my shoes. Are those Jordans? You know it. I've never seen these colors before. That's because a friend of mine made them. I need a friend like that. When a lady compliments your J's, she's a keeper. This time, I noticed her name tag, Natasha. I was absolutely certain that he would like her, but I didn't say anything to her. I wanted Ryan's blessing on her photo first. I left the bank and realized that I was running late. The branch was located adjacent to downtown in the southeast pocket of Koreatown, and I had to get to the Ice House, a comedy club in Pasadena, which, with traffic, could end up taking me 60 to 70 minutes at this early evening hour. No more than 5 minutes passed when I got a call from a number I didn't recognize. I usually don't answer those, but this day, I did. Hello?
Tom Segura?
Yes?
This is Carlos from Wells Fargo.
I was impressed. You usually don't get customer service follow-ups this quickly, but I was happy to tell them how well they were doing. Hi, Carlos. I'm very happy with my accounts and with the service I received.
I'm from the security division of Wells Fargo. Is there a reason you were taking photos inside the branch today? We have you on video.
Everything slowed down. I felt my voice drop and my vision blurred. Am I having an aneurysm? My first instinct was to try to diffuse the situation with a lighthearted question. Oh, I mean, do you think I took them to rob the bank?
I don't know. Did you?
What kind of fucking idiot am I, volunteering that? Do you think I'm going to rob you? No, I wasn't, and I'm not planning on ever robbing your or any other bank.
So why were you taking a picture?
I was taking a photo of the teller so I could show her to my friend for a potential date. Fuck, that can't sound good.
So you were taking photos of the teller?
Yeah, I think her name is Natasha. Sorry.
Sir, we don't appreciate our employees' privacy being violated.
Yep, no, I totally understand. I apologize. I'm so sorry. I felt like he got it. He got it that I got it. We're probably good now.
I need you to delete those photos.
Rup, yep, mm-hmm, right away. I couldn't believe it, but Carlos had a power over me that I'd never experienced. He was ordering me over the phone to delete pictures from my phone, and I was 100% complying. I wasn't just saying it. I slowed down, opened my photos, and deleted the couple I had taken just as I was told to. Done, just deleted. Really, I'm so sorry about that.
Please, don't do that again, sir.
Absolutely not. That was a very, very stupid mistake on my part. I'm dumb.
Just be aware that you are now on a list.
You have to be shitting me. List?
It's a potential threat list that all bank security divisions share.
All Wells Fargo's?
No. All banks in the United States. You were immediately added when you were seen taking the photos today.
Jesus. How long am I on the list?
Indefinitely.
My first thought was regretting that I deleted those photos. I mean, if I'm on a list indefinitely, I should at least have the evidence on me. But now I had bigger problems. Does the list mean I can't have a bank account? I needed to know. Can I still bank at the branch?
That will be up to them.
The line went dead. Carlos had hung up on me. I was practically shitting myself. I felt like the FBI was going to be waiting for me at the ice house. I arrived there about 30 minutes later, and thankfully, they weren't. But Ryan Sickler was. I told him the whole ordeal, that I'd seen her again, snapped a few photos, and been called by bank security, ordered to delete them, and now I was on a national watch list of potential threats to all banks. Ryan's response?
You didn't delete the photos of her, did you?
Of course I did.
Why?
Because Carlos told me to.
How's he gonna know what's on your phone?
Carlos knows, man. Carlos just knows. Now I was in a world of shit because Ryan didn't take my word that this woman was hot. I don't remember how I got through my show that night, but the next day I went back to the bank just after they opened. I asked to speak to the manager. She was a woman in her 30s, and surprisingly, she was very understanding. I told her about the incident before security did. They'll probably brief me after lunch. I asked if I was still allowed to bank there, and she said, of course. I was so relieved. I felt like I had gone to confession. But there was one thing left to do. I needed to apologize to Natasha. The manager had her come to the office, and she left me, a potential threat, in there with her all alone. I came clean and told Natasha the whole story. I was so embarrassed by all of it, but you know what she did? She laughed. She thought it was sweet. You know, I am single. Do you want to go out with my friend? This would make such a great story. You got a picture? Actually, I do. I had tons of photos of Ryan. We'd been friends for 15 years at that point. I took my time, told her I had to find a good one. I scrolled until I saw one of him smiling. It was taken at a party. And if I were building a dating profile for him, I would have made it his main picture. She looked for a long beat, considering what to do. Her eyes danced around. Her head moved a little, a sway. And then,
Not my type.
I had to laugh. We parted as friends, and since they both now knew the story, they eventually found each other on Facebook. Ryan called me.
I should have trusted you, man.
Why is that?
Natasha. God damn, she looks good.
I fucking told you, man. I'm on a federal watch list because you don't trust your friend. No fat chicks. No fat chicks. Phil said this. Phil is a fellow comedian. He sat across from me at lunch, and my face couldn't hide my bewilderment. I wasn't so taken aback that I lost my ability to speak, but I couldn't hide the emotion on my face, and he saw that. I was looking into Phil's eyes, and he knew what I saw. A very large man. He was 6'3" and well over 300 pounds. You see, Phil was quite fat himself. Some might even say, very fat. He was smart, witty, and cutting. Phil was extremely opinionated, and that had some appeal, I suppose. He wasn't ugly, but he's the type of guy whom I thought would be thrilled just to have a woman talk to him. But it turns out it was exactly the opposite. Phil was demanding when it came to the opposite sex. Not only did he proclaim no fat chicks, he also listed other necessities. She needed to be hot, make good money, and, quote, not be annoying. I laughed, a real laugh. I couldn't believe that this tub of shit, who had clearly done little to no work on his physical appearance, would require a woman who was devoted to hers. No fat chicks? Dude, you're fat. You're fat too. Yeah, we're not talking about me. You're the one saying no fat chicks, and you're very fat. He wasn't budging, and then he pulled out his phone and showed me something. Photos of a beautiful girl. She was hot. I kept swiping photos of her in a bikini, in short shorts, and then it was just the two of them together, laughing, kissing. Who is she? Just some chick I dated for a while. She got annoying. You broke up with her? Yep. He casually let it out, like I had asked him, do they have paper towels in the bathroom? Yep. Now I was more intrigued. Phil, the giant turd of a human being who possessed little to no redeeming qualities save for a snarky, sometimes biting sense of humor, had disposed of what would surely be the most attractive woman who would ever come within smelling distance of him because she got annoying. You should really let this woman annoy you. You'll never get anything like this again. I was serious. I was sure he'd made a grave mistake. I'm talking to another chick. He handed me his phone, and again, I was blown away. Another stunner. Was he poisoning these women? Why would they go out with Phil? He was doing that shit I'd heard about when I was really young and never took to. He'd even adopted the rallying cry I'd heard countless idiots say, girls like assholes. It's a philosophy I never really understood. Girls like assholes? What? How does that make any sense? You might be hearing this and thinking, wait a minute, Tom. You're an asshole. I get it. I get that I can be an asshole on a mic. On stage, sure. On the podcast, sometimes. But in real life, I try to keep being an asshole to a minimum. And it was absolutely never my approach with women. I should also add that I wasn't the most successful with women, but I was far from a failure. Maybe I should have been an asshole. But I always thought if you like someone, oh, I don't know, try being nice to them. But here I am looking across the table at Philly Pig Tits, showing me photos of him with an absolute dime piece. This guy was the biggest oblivious asshole possible, and it was actually working for him. But it's not just big fat Phil, is it? Time and time again, we see guys who frankly have no business having any standards dating beautiful women. Of course, it's easy to dismiss it as the oldest exchange in the world. Rich man has money, beautiful woman has her beauty. They each have something the other wants. Sure, that dynamic will never end, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about rich guys. I'm talking about guys like Phil. They're everywhere. They're fucking entitled, and they have no reason to be. They're just alive. I've met couples like this in all kinds of settings, wedding receptions, dinner parties, house parties, after my shows.
not rich, Phil-looking motherfucker with a stunning woman. It's made me realize a couple of things. One, every man in the world can get laid, and I wish they knew it. I really do. Missing a tooth? Have a wound that oozes from your face? It might seem improbable, but there is a woman willing to sleep with you. I am completely convinced of this. It's one of the certainties in this world that has made me completely believe that women are the better species. I'm not saying this to suck up. I'm saying it because it's true. And I wish more men realized that they really do have a shot with a woman. Let me be clear. I'm not saying every man has a shot with every woman. I'm just saying women forgive a lot more flaws than we do. Still, I can't stop thinking about what a shitbag Phil is. But when I start to go down that rabbit hole, I have to remind myself that I'm not much better than him. He's definitely a bigger dick and grossly entitled. But if I'm being honest with myself, I can think of lots of ridiculous